The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Will they be able to decrease the huge monetary base they have in time and raise the interest rate? I expect that this may not be sufficient because of political and psychological pressure on the Fed. And this would mean a higher inflation in time in the United States.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Peter Bernholtz. We will be continuing with the question and answer session next week when David returns. But this week, David speaks with Peter Bernholtz, Professor Emeritus of Economics for the Center of Economics and Business in Basel, Switzerland. Peter's best known for the book that he's written on monetary regimes and inflation, which analyzes the 29 hyperinflations in world history. Strangely enough, 28 of the 29 hyperinflations occurred in the 20th century and were brought about mainly because of the removal of gold, the gold discipline, from the currency. We go to that interview now.
Peter Bernholtz, we think of inflationary periods going back to Athens and Rome in ancient times. You highlight the fact that the worst inflations occurred only in the 20th century. That needs an explanation and further exploration.
Yes, except for the French hyperinflation at the Great Revolution, but it was also based on pure fiat money. So it is the first example of what has been happening since the abolishment of the gold standard.
And so it really is an issue of what is backing your money. If there is something backing your money, it's much more difficult to inflate versus without a backing, which is really the context that we've had following 1914 and particularly 1930. There seems to be definitive changes in the trend almost universally after 1930, but particularly following 1914. First, let's look at the difference in trajectory for inflation before these time frames and then after these dates. Perhaps then we can fast forward to the 1970s, where again there seemed to be an acceleration of inflation.
Yeah, after 1914 and finally in the big depression of the 1930s, the gold standard was really given up. This means that all the paper money which had before to be exchanged into gold at a fixed parity at the wish of the public was given up, you see. And now we had some weakened gold standard in the renewal after Second World War by the Bretton Woods system. But this referred only to central banks. Central banks could still change their dollar holdings into gold at a fixed parity with the American Treasury. But this was limited to central banks. But it was at least a binding condition established again after the Second World War for those countries which joined the Bretton Woods system. After that, let's say 1971 to 73, we had not even this weak connection to gold. And this meant that each country was able to multiply, if it wanted, its monetary base at its own discretion. I could put it together and say that there is no longer any budgetary restraint to central banks. And actually, one of Hungarian Kornai pointed out in the 70s that one of the big weaknesses of the planned economy systems of the socialist East were that they had no binding budget restraints for firms, businesses, and so on. And we now have no binding budget constraints for central banks.
That's interesting. Essentially, your book points out all hyperinflations in history, with that one exception, the French, which you mentioned earlier, have occurred after 1914. Now, mankind is tempted to think that technology and direct management bring about better results. Clearly, this is a case where the world's money mandarins, with improved technology, might not have made things better at all.
Yeah, we have two facts at the moment. The first I pointed already out, namely that the central banks are able to increase the monetary base as much as they want. And as long as there is a fixed relationship between the broader money and the monetary base, then the broader money will also increase at the same or more rapid pace. Only if, because of expectations, this relationship between the two kinds of money can change as we have it in the present situation, then no inflation may occur.
So the central bank creating money, expanding the monetary base, it requires the money multiplier to increase, to see money used by the public also increase.
Yeah, the banks are required, of course, and you know it yourself, always to exchange your holdings at the banks in checking accounts at a fixed rate into banknotes. And the banknotes belong to the monetary base. As long as this is the case, the money created by the banks cannot increase more than the monetary base.
Tell us more about the inflationary bias of political systems.
Yeah, that's the second reason. In fact, I personally have shown that usually politicians and therefore the government have an inflationary bias. And this is understandable if I speak as a public choice economist, because if you want to deliver good things to people, it's always good to increase, at least in the short run until the next elections, the expenditures more than the tax revenues. And this means, of course, that you have a deficit. As long as you can finance the deficit in the financial markets, it's okay. But there are certain limits to that. And if these limits are reached, the temptation for governments is great to press the central banks, and often they have the full control of central banks, for financing their deficits with the creation of the monetary base.
This is a fascinating point. Is the inflationary bias of political systems more or less true in a democracy or a dictatorship?
This is true, obviously, for all monetary regimes, even for democracies. Even in history, before we had this fiat paper money system, there have been in England, for instance, some debasements of metallic coins by using less base metal or whatever it is. And there are examples in history that the public represented in some kinds of parliaments, even it was not a general parliament at that time, they had an agreement with the king. If he stopped inflation, they would agree to an increase of the tax base.
That's interesting. Well, this idea of a political business cycle, can you explain that idea, how that works?
I should add first that one of the efforts to prevent that this political bias works itself out is the creation of independent central banks. If they are really independent, they will have some inflation because of political and psychological pressure on central bankers and their own aims, but this cannot get out of bounds, you see. And now to your question, how do I explain that? Yes, it's obvious that politicians are re-elected whenever they can grant some benefits to the public or to special interest groups, and on the other hand, have not to increase taxes, you see, at least not visible taxes. And as a consequence, it happens very often that a budget deficit occurs. And this is especially the case since the negative consequences of increasing the deficit occur usually only after the next election, because we have a time lag there.
That's very fascinating. Well, you've commented that there has never occurred a hyperinflation in history which was not caused by a huge budget deficit. Could you expand on that?
At least this is true for all the hyperinflations and very high inflations. And even with the metallic money, the highest inflation they could reach with the debasement of the metallic money was during the 4th century and following of the Roman Empire, but this amounted on the average only to 8% per annum. You couldn't get more without having fiat money or so.
Well, and this is very interesting that there is a limitation to inflation with metallic money.
Yes.
And no limits when you're talking about paper money. Now, you talked about Rome. The low rates of inflation, we are told, which are benign, and in fact, today the argument amongst economists is that low rates of inflation promote economic growth. Can you comment on the cumulative effect of low rates of inflation? How benign are they?
It's true that we have a certain positive influence sometimes, especially if it is only a short change and not permanent, on employment and business activity. But with inflations at least of more than 10%, this absolutely vanishes and turns around, you see. And also, at the moment, of course, we have much discussion of the dangers of inflation, and most leading central banks look to have a certain inflation rate target of 2% per annum. And I'm personally very skeptical about that. For instance, during the gold standard, the price level was kept stable, and this means that because you have sometimes some exuberant, let's say, economic feelings and some higher growth, where the prices increase, you need also some periods where you have a slight deflation to get the prices down again, to have this average not increasing at all of the price level. And this means that we have from the gold standard quite a lot of evidence that together with mild inflation, we had real economic growth. Therefore, the fear, if the expectation is that you have long-term stability of the population, then it's quite clear that mild deflations are not dangerous at all, you see. I have looked into the evidence for Britain, because it was at that time the leading power, you see, with the gold standard. And there we have quite a number of such developments where benign, mild deflation did not prohibit real economic growth.
We have, as you say, real concerns amongst central banks today that any sort of deflation emerge. So this target 2% inflation has come to be quite popular. The Romans had, on average, about 4.4% inflation. And
yes,
on the surface, that does not sound that bad. And yet, the cumulative effect between 238 AD and 361 AD caused a 1,000,000-fold increase in the price of wheat. Now, we in the United States, over the last 100 years, have averaged a CPI increase, a consumer price inflation rate, that's been between 3.5% and 4%. Not quite what the Romans had, but still what most would say is a manageable level.
Yeah, it's manageable, but you have to realize, for instance, if you compare the dollar to the Swiss franc, we had in former times a rate of 4.2 Swiss francs for $1. Now the price is below 1 franc for $1. And this means, of course, that much damage has been done to people who have saved, you see, in terms of dollar. Of course, if you have a predictable rate of inflation. Let's say you would have all the time 2% inflation per year. And if it could be predicted by everybody, then you would have just an interest rate taking this into account. And then people would not have any problems. The only problem would then the bonds issued by the government would have also to have these higher interest rates. But this is not the real story most of the times, because suddenly the government or the central bank increases the rate of inflation, as happened before the Volcker reforms in the United States. Then this unexpected thing lowers the public debt of the government, but it also erodes the savings of the public.
So again, we find a political bias for inflation helping essentially to lower the cost or the burden of debt, with the added cost being subtly a denigration of private savings. Now, let's go back to what you commented on the exchange rate between the dollar and the Swiss franc. We are used to looking at an annual inflation rate, and we do a year-over-year comparison. So compared to last year, this year's rate of inflation is, let's call it 2%, or 1.8%, or 2.2%, or whatever it may be. But your reference was interesting, because what you've basically done is rolled the clock back and said, if we choose a base year and compare where we were years ago to today, you see an over 75% decline in the purchasing power of the dollar.
Yeah.
That's very significant to a saver, but that certainly is not how inflation is presented today. Can you comment on those year-over-year comparisons versus choosing a base year for comparisons?
What I can state is the United States has, of course, enjoyed a reasonable rate of growth of the real economy GDP, for instance. It has not suffered really. The inflation may have had some distributional effects, and usually it goes disfavoring the poorer part of the population, because they usually don't have the knowledge and the possibility to safeguard themselves against inflation, you see. Whereas the wealthier part of the population, whenever it is well informed, can go into good stocks, you see, and other financial instruments to safeguard their savings. But I should also point out that Switzerland, fortunately for us, has had the lowest long-term inflation since the First World War, we can say, of all nations. But our real economy has also been growing satisfactorily. This is not by chance that our per capita income is also rather high.
Let's talk about Switzerland just a moment, and then we'll come back to your book. It's a unique perspective I think you could bring to the current referendum on gold and an increase in gold backing the Swiss currency. Do you care to comment?
Yes, I have written on this in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, the leading newspaper here. Actually, I would not have anything against an increase in the stock of gold with the Swiss National Bank, but the popular initiative, which is now at stake, you see, they make one big mistake. You see, they will ask the Swiss National Bank to increase their gold stock to 20% of its reserves, but then it should not be allowed to ever lower the gold which it has bought, you see. This means, of course, that whenever the Swiss National Bank would need its reserves for different reasons, it could not reduce its gold stock, you see. And I think this is one of the main weaknesses of this initiative. If it could be made flexible, that the Swiss National Bank could look at gold just as a part of its portfolio, as it could take in also, let's say, foreign stocks and so, then I would be satisfied. But this is not the case.
Well, thank you for that. Going back to where we were discussing earlier with the Romans, it was under Diocletian that price controls were implemented that failed to tame the inflation in the 4th century. And then ultimately the death penalty was introduced. My question is this. When you have a failing system, it's very common to see the bureaucrats in that system, the governing body, if you will, become desperate. This is what you saw in the 4th century in Rome. Are there any limits to what government will do? What are the implications for the individual in the context of a failing system and a full-blown inflation? Are there governmental limits, and what are the implications for individuals?
Price controls have been never successful in the long run. This is quite obvious, beginning with the price controls by the late Roman emperors, you see, to the present, they are very limited. Also, if inflation is high, the governments can do what they want. We have even cases where it was not allowed in high inflations to buy or even to quote prices in stable money or to buy foreign money. This was not allowed. But even if you put a death penalty, or as the French did during the Great Revolution, 20 years in chain as a penalty on it, it did not work, you see. In the end, if the inflation is very high indeed, hyperinflation, then you cannot prevent, if you do not a successful currency reform in the hand, the bad inflating money is perfectly driven out by sound, stable money. As recently happened in the 2008 and 2007 in Zimbabwe, where the inflating money was fully driven out by the dollar and the South African rand, you see. So the governments are limited in what they can do. The same is now the problem in Argentina. In Argentina, they have also followed, again, a wrong policy and have not very high inflation. But this is sufficient to be a danger for a fixed exchange rate to the dollar. And this has already broken down. Now they have introduced several exchange controls, but in the long run, this will not be working.
You've also discussed in your book there being a lag between an increase in the money supply and a subsequent increase in prices. Can you discuss that lag, and is that different than what we discussed earlier, expansion of the monetary base and ultimately needing the money multiplier to increase money used by the public? Are we talking about two different things?
At the moment, as I mentioned, the broader money, what we usually call M2 and M3, has not increased too much. Therefore, we have not to expect much of inflation, you see. But this depends, again, on this money multiplier. The relationship of the monetary base to this broader money has very much increased, or vice versa, decreased. And looking at the facts, you see, I have seen about the same, but not to the same degree, the 1930s Great Depression. But someday this will turn around again because of expectations. If the expectations change to, let's say, normal conditions, and this happens if the real economy picks up and if inflation expectations become positive, then this money multiplier will go back probably to the old level. At least it has done so after the 1930s. And this means then that slowly, we don't know at which time, because we cannot predict very well expectations. But it means that finally the rate of inflation will go up if you don't decrease the monetary base in time. This means that you have to increase all the interest in time. And what I suppose which might happen, but I'm not speaking as a monetary economist, but as a public choice economist, and this is of course less certain than the former one. What could happen is the following, that, for instance, in the United States, where the Fed is still leading the whole thing, they have already stopped the increase of the monetary base, as you know, and are considering when to increase interest rates. But the question is, will they be able to decrease the huge monetary base they have, which is quite extraordinary by all historical standards, in time and raise in time the interest rates? I expect that this may not be sufficient because of political and psychological pressure on the Fed. And this would mean that you would be seeing a higher inflation in time in the United States. I usually like to refer to an anecdote, you see, which happened in Germany when the Nazis had taken over power. Hitler, the new chancellor, asked an economist in his administration to comment on the fears of bankers and economists that inflation might result if he would increase very much the monetary base, you see. Of course, they use other expressions, but you may allow me to say monetary base. And then this economist answered, "Herr Hitler, you are now the mightiest man in Germany, but what you are not able to do is to bring about an inflation now." And this has been exactly our situation. But what happened in Germany then? After 5 years, the Nazis introduced the first price controls. And in the beginning of 1939, the central bank, under the same leader who had formerly introduced the expansion of the monetary base, Hjalmar Schacht, wrote a letter to Hitler that with such a fiscal policy financed by money creation, no stable currency could be preserved. Hitler, of course, just dismissed the whole body of the central bankers. And what happened, you know, during the war, the mark went down to zero, you see. And in the United States, you had similar but not so dramatic situation. With the beginning of the war, at least, the inflation began and this money which had been created and additionally further money which was created resulted in inflation.
As a historian of these matters, as someone who has reflected on inflationary dynamics and budget deficits and the causal relationships, the contributory factors, could you reflect with us for a moment?
Yeah, the dynamics is the following. In the beginning, when the broader money is increased strongly, the population is not aware of what has been happening, except perhaps for a few experts, you see. And this means that the money supply is increasing more rapidly than the price level, of course, taking into account the real growth of GDP, which has to be deducted. But as soon as the public realizes, after usually a few years, what is happening, this turns around because the public is then fleeing from the money because they realize that it's rapidly losing its value. And then this means that the money supply is lagging behind the development of the price level. This means that the real stock of money, that is the nominal money divided by the price level of the inflating money, is decreasing. And at the same time, the people turn also to barter, but mostly they turn to some stable foreign money. And in all hyperinflations and high inflations, the stable foreign money, as I mentioned before, against all penalties and fines, is then driving out the inflating money. This is the dynamics which is happening.
Would you think that these dynamics might be witnessed in future years in places like Japan or the United States?
Yeah, I don't expect for the United States that you will be entering very high inflation, but I expect a sizable inflation Of course, it's very difficult to say anything about the range, but I'm also somewhat disquieted that some of my Harvard colleagues already say it would be preferable if we had 4 to 5% inflation to reduce the debt of the government and to get the economy moving even faster. And I think this would be a very dangerous development. And it might be that you would get 4 or 5% inflation, and then the Fed would probably act against it, you see. But this is, of course, speculation, especially since I have to take in the public choice relationships between government, Federal Reserve, and the influence of the feelings of the public on politics, you see. And that's much more difficult to predict.
With a 4 to 5% rate of inflation, would you agree that inflation expectations amongst the general public would most likely change?
Yeah, they would increase then. And this makes it also much more difficult than my Harvard colleagues expect to stabilize the inflation. Because then the public reacts, of course, by increasing their expenditures, you see. And of course, in the bond market, the interest rate will go up because people would like to take into account the inflation rate. So you have some dynamics developing, and this makes it more difficult for the central bank to stabilize the system.
We mentioned earlier this idea of increasing interest rates. From a fiscal standpoint, we already spend about 10% of our revenues here in the United States on interest payments.
Yeah.
It seems that there are practical limitations to how much the Fed can increase interest rates.
Yes, that's exactly why I think that there will be strong pressure by the government on the Fed, not only because of the influence on unemployment, but also because the government deficit, which is very high already, would be increased very much if the real interest rates, that is the interest rates minus inflation, would increase, which would be necessary to stabilize the situation.
I must ask this question. You mentioned earlier that you're not as concerned with accelerating inflation in the United States or very debilitating rates of inflation in the United States, and yet we have very large deficits. We also have direct monetization of our debts, and that's what we've witnessed over the last 3 or 4 years. We're seeing a growing trend of central banks all over the world monetizing debts, whether it's public or private. Does that monetization at all concern you, given the historical references where monetization created incredibly high rates of inflation?
Yes, I have proven in this book, Monetary Regimes and Inflation, that in my view, all hyperinflations, and there are very many other high inflations, have usually been caused by deficits of the government financed by money creation.
We have the Japanese now not only monetizing debt, but taking freshly printed money and putting it directly into the stock market. Can you think of a historical precedent similar to that?
Japan is a special case. They have increased the money supply very much indeed, even much more than the United States, which has a record from all historical perspectives also. But Japan and the government debt is now, I think, 230% of gross domestic product. I don't see how they can get out of this. And they now trying again to increase the money supply very much. And I cannot believe that there will not be someday a day of reckoning.
As an individual, there you live in Basel, Switzerland. Where do you see danger and opportunity in the world that we live in?
I really should not comment on this, but I personally think if you have very high inflation, then you need gold. That's obvious. In the long run, of course, stocks are doing the same, but during the inflation itself, they have usually also a depressed value in real terms, and this is only recovering when the inflation has ended. And also the same is true very often for housing, landed property, and so on, because the government tends in such a situation of high inflation to introduce price controls there.
That is, to housing and property, price controls apply.
Yeah. And at least this was the case in many inflations, because the politicians are afraid that they lose the voices of people renting their property. And therefore, they want to prevent that and introducing price controls. And the same they have done for public transportation and other things. And therefore, the relative prices have been going, usually during inflation, against landed property, at least buildings where you have many people renting apartments or houses.
We have another edition of your book that will be coming out within the next few months, Monetary Regimes and Inflation, History, Economic, and Political Relationships. An excellent book, an absolute must for a library concerned about or related to monetary matters, economic matters, political matters. You're adding a chapter to this book, as well as expanding on some of the relationships between central bank money, the monetary base expansion, and the money multiplier.
This relationship I am now covering in the beginning with some additional paragraphs, you see. And then I go also at the chapter, as I mentioned, chapter 9, which discusses under which conditions you can have inflation-stable monetary regimes and under which conditions they are abolished or at least eroded, you see. And these are usually conditions which I discuss very closely also through history.
I believe this is the first book which strongly identifies, argues, and supports the idea of inflationary bias being a part of a political system, and incredibly helpful, incredibly insightful. That and many other insights that you bring in your book. I would encourage listeners to order a copy. If you want the second edition, wait just a few months. Otherwise, the first edition is just as good. And Peter, thank you very much for the time you've spent with us, as well as the time that you've spent understanding these issues.
Yes. Good afternoon, then. Bye.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Peter Bernholtz. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.